Harris matter.
Morning.
Good morning, Mr. Mokris.
Mokris.
Mokris, I was almost right.
Yeah, listen, that's a lot better than trying to figure out. In Boynton, it's Judge Bales. And in Richmond, it's Judge Beals. So, you know.
I'm happy whichever you call it.
I'm always gonna nail it wrong, so. But welcome, you may proceed.
May it please the court, I would like to reserve 5 minutes. I don't anticipate this taking long at all. This is a single issue, a sufficiency of evidence on a, whether something should be considered an aggravated malicious wounding or a simple malicious wounding. In this instance, it's my argument that it should be considered a simple malicious wounding. For cosmetic injuries, I think that there needs to be a permanent and significant injury above and beyond the cosmetic disfigurement. And additionally, the case law in Newton indicates that the injury, cosmetic disfigurement, needs to be obvious and visible. And in this case, it just wasn't. I mean, what happened is the injury was above the hairline. And
excuse me, didn't the judge say that he could see it from the bench? Or did that I understand that?
Yes, after the judge stood up and she manipulated her hair, he was able to see that. He was able to see the injury because it required, I think, 13 or 14 staples. The record was not clear on that. However,
the picture shows
her,
the staples pretty. Once she moved her hair,
right,
you could see a large area that was stapled.
That's correct, but she did have to move her hair. And her testimony, Ms. Morris's testimony, was that absent moving that hair, that injury was basically not visible. I wouldn't say invisible, but it was not visible to the naked eye. And I think
Can I ask you, Mr. Mokris, on that? Suppose she were a man who was almost entirely bald. Would the result be different than if she's a woman who has large, nice, you know, nice hair that covers the scar, or if she were one of the swimmers who shaves her head, you know?
I think the answer to that is definitely yes. And the reason is because if the court looks at Newton, when it's referring to the obvious and visible, it indicated that at trial, 5 months after the attack, the scar from that facial wound was still obvious and visible, even though Bryant had grown a beard. And then it goes on to say, but there were additional visible scars because there was a scarring of the ear where the person in Newton had been.
But in this case, she had to move her hair, and doesn't the evidence show that there was no hair growing where that scar, where the staples had been? I mean, that she had covered it up with her hair, so she...
Correct.
But if she had pulled her hair straight back or chose to wear it in a different style, it would have been visible. Do you dispute that?
No, I do not dispute that. However, in this case, her hair did make that injury not visible, except with her manipulating her hair in order to make it visible.
But there was a permanent scar.
There was definitely a permanent scar, and I concede that. And however, there has to be something more than a permanent scar. And one of the things that I don't think that the Court of Appeals or Supreme Court of Virginia has addressed is what's significant. And I think that when the court looks at the determining whether something's aggravated malicious wounding or a simple malicious wounding, I think that significant goes towards whether how obvious and visible the scar in question is. And in this case, by Ms. Morris's own testimony, it was not.
And following that view, of course, it seems to me what you're asking us to do is focus not upon the severity of the injury and how it appears, but how the victim makes it appear. I mean, how it affected the victim rather than the severity of the injury and just the appearance that anybody might be able to receive from that same injury. I mean, that sort of tries to detail it to looking at whether the victim is able to, just the characteristics of the victim are able, it's obvious from that victim.
Well, I think that the court, as it always needs to do, is use its common sense, and pretty much every person, whether they're male or female,
right,
unless they're bald or have significant hair issues, if they have that injury, it's going to be covered by their hair, and it's not going to be visible.
What about her testimony, though, that doesn't seem to be contradicted, that ever since this, she didn't have headaches before, but ever since this, she wakes up almost every morning with a significant headache.
Right, and I would argue that was, it was plainly wrong by the court to take her testimony at face value. And first of all, she not only was a convicted felon, but she also was convicted of crimes involving moral turpitude. And then, so generally speaking, I understand that the Court of Appeals and the Supreme Court of Virginia have gone out of their way to expand what a victim can testify to. However, that's my argument in that case would be that normally a victim should be able to testify as to something that's visible to them, a broken arm that has, with the bones protruding, or the loss of hearing, something that they, because of their own common observations, can testify to. However, in this instance, that is not the case. She had a CT scan. There was no medical evidence or expert testimony provided that would indicate that there was any nexus between her headaches and the alleged event, the robbery, abduction, malicious wounding. So when I believe, is my position, that in an instant where the victim is not inherently credible, now obviously whether a witness is credible or is not, it's up to the circuit court judge. However, in this case, it'd be my position that when it's an issue that's not readily obtainable or reasonably observable by a victim, when that victim comes before the court with the added baggage of having both a felony conviction as well as convictions for crimes involving moral turpitude, then I think that it's incumbent upon the court to have some additional indicia of reliability in that instance.
But does the record indicate Judge Osborne just accepted it at face value? I mean, did
yes. There's nothing to indicate that.
But I mean, he knew her record, right? That was
yes.
put before him, and
he
watched her testify, which we of course can't do.
Correct.
So why shouldn't he be the ultimate decider of her credibility, as long as he's not plainly wrong or there's no
credible
evidence
to
support it?
I think in this instance he was plainly wrong, because I don't think that there is sufficient guidance from the Court of Appeals or the Supreme Court of Virginia to say what is the cutoff for a victim to testify to their injuries. It was initially just visible injuries. It's gone beyond that, but how far it's gone beyond that, I think that the circuit court judges left to their own discretion. And in this instance, when it's a question as to headaches after the alleged altercation or incident, and then there's no additional medical evidence, then I think that the court has gone beyond what they ought to do.
Any other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning and now good afternoon, just about. It pleases the court, my name is Chris Chandeville, represent the Commonwealth in this appeal. This is a case which really fits consistently with a long line of Virginia cases on aggravated malicious wounding. And so I think in order to maybe sidestep some of that case law, instead of distinguishing those cases, what Harris is here today asking this court for is really a new rule that Harris reads out of the Newton case, which is 20 years old. And I would argue that that case, decided in 1995, does not establish the obvious and visible rule that Harris reads it to establish. And that also the second rule that I read him to be asking for in his brief, that medical testimony should have been required in this case, that is not the law here in Virginia, and even was not argued in that light in the trial court. So I'd like to start with Newton and Harris's reading of Newton. As I read Newton, there's nothing in that opinion that can be interpreted to mean that the Court of Appeals was attempting to create some sort of new obvious and visible rule for injuries which result in cosmetic disfigurement. If you look at the court's discussion of the victim's injuries in that case, the court talks about what the trial court focused on. The trial court focused on the fact that the victim did have scars on the face, and did have multiple wounds, some to the face, some to the wrist, and some to the back, and also that those wounds required stitches. And the trial court did say that one of the scars was still obvious and visible. The Court of Appeals cites the trial court for that finding of fact, but nothing in the record demonstrates the Court of Appeals was trying to say in every case going forward where there's a cosmetic disfigurement and that's the only injury, you have to have a showing that that cosmetic disfigurement was obvious and visible. That would be akin to taking one of these cases where the victim was shot and the bullet lodged in the victim's back. There are a couple cases like that. It would be akin to taking one of those cases and saying, well, now going forward in every case where there's aggravated malicious wounding on the basis of a shooting, there has to be this extra showing that the bullet lodged next to the spine in order to conclude the malicious wounding was aggravated. Of course, we can't take one individual fact from one case and extrapolate a rule for all cases going forward, unless the court makes it clear that that's what it's doing. And the court just did not do that in Newton. The second argument I would make as to Newton versus Commonwealth is that the premise by which Harris argues that that new rule would even apply in this case is just wrong. The proposed rule, as I understand it, is that in cases where the only injury is cosmetic disfigurement, then you need this extra showing. In this case, of course, we also have the headaches, so that new rule, even if it was based in good law, wouldn't be applicable in this case unless this court is somehow required to discard her testimony about her headaches, which of course leads to the second, which looked like a proposed rule for all cases involving headaches from the brief. I don't know, listening to argument, that he's asking for a new rule for all cases, but the argument is at least that in this case there should have been some medical testimony because her testimony was impeached by the fact that she has a prior record. Your Honor asked if there was any indication in the record whether the trial court accepted her testimony at face value or actually made some sort of credibility determination based on something that the trial judge observed. And I would argue that on page 172 of the appendix, the court does actually give some explanation as to why this witness, this victim, is believed in her testimony by the trial court. If you get down towards the end of the page, the court does talk about the fact that she does have prior convictions, but the very last paragraph of page 172, the trial court says, but she comes before the court and she admits that she was involved in the conspiracy to distribute marijuana. That's what this is all about. She contacted him to get some marijuana. So the court seems to be relying on the fact that her testimony is bolstered by the fact that she is admitting, yes, I was involved in some criminal activity. As a part of her testimony, she's not hiding from that, she's not downplaying that. There's no reason to believe that she's less than credible. She's accepting her role in this. And so I would argue that is part of the credibility determination, and that there's no reason for this court to revisit that credibility determination here. We wanted to answer any questions that the court might have, and if not, I'll rest on my brief.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't have any additional evidence if the court has any additional questions.
We do.
No further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Come down and greet counsel.